Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is Chris Holm, the author of The Collector Trilogy and The Killing Kind. His latest novel is Red Right Hand, the latest entry in the Michael Hendricks saga, which follows a hitman with a heart of, we'll say sterling silver. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the reading, would you mind just setting up the book a little bit? What is the story of Red Right Hand?
Sure. So Red Right Hand is the second in my Michael Hendricks series. The Killing Kind, the first book in the series, set up the character as a hitman who only hits other hitmen. He's a former Special Forces soldier, long thought dead, who did some things he wasn't proud of on the government's behalf in Afghanistan. And this is his way sort of squaring his accounts and trying to atone for that. As you can imagine, he ran afoul of some pretty nasty people who were unhappy that he was killing their hitmen. And they, in turn, sent somebody after him who targeted the people he loves in an effort to get to him. Red Right Hand picks up in the wake of that when he's hunting down an organization called the Council. But it also deals with a terror attack on U.S. soil. The viral video capturing that terror attack happens to capture somebody who was a former federal witness for the Council. And so Michael Hendricks decides he needs to go get his hands on that guy, protect him from the Council, and hopefully use the intel he can gather from him to take them down.
If you're ready, would you mind reading a little bit from the book?
Certainly. I'll read the prologue, which was actually a late addition to the book. It was at the recommendation of my editor because it appeared a little later in Flashback, and he thought, God, what a hook for the book that'd be. Let's put it up front and use it to introduce this character who is known as the Devil's Red Right Hand throughout the book.
It was a great idea because it pulls you right in.
Thank you very much. I wish I could take credit for it. That was Josh Kendall at Mulholland Books. So here we go. The man staggered into the lobby of the Albuquerque field office shortly after 3 a.m. His hair, black streaked with gray, was matted down by rain. His face was dusted with stubble and deeply lined. Tattered clothing clung to his lithe frame. His feet were bare and bleeding. Water, tinged red, pooled beneath him. Special Agent Charlie Thompson glanced up from her paperwork in surprise. He hadn't shown up on any of the building's exterior surveillance cameras. If it weren't for the sudden roar of the storm through the open door, she might not have noticed him come in. Thompson had graduated from Quantico only a month before, but somehow she'd already managed to piss off her new boss. Yancey had her pulling overnights on the front desk all week. Truthfully, she didn't mind. The odd phone call aside, conspiracy nuts usually, too tangled up in their delusions to sleep. The graveyard shift was pretty quiet. Tonight, though, a thunderstorm had blown in like the wrath of God. Lightning forked across the sky. Rolling thunder shook the building. Sheets of rain reduced the streetlights to blurry smears. Poor guy's probably just a vagrant trying to get in out of the rain, Thompson thought, although for some reason, she didn't quite believe it. Can I help you? She asked. Pale blue eyes regarded Thompson from bruised sockets. The man opened his mouth to speak, but all that came out was a dry croak. He swallowed hard, wincing, and limped across the lobby toward her. As he approached, she realized his knuckles were scraped raw. She flashed him a smile intended to disarm and surreptitiously thumbed the emergency alert button on the two-way radio clipped to her belt. When he reached the desk, he tried again. I need to talk to the special agent in charge. The words came out thick and wrong. Dried blood was caked in the creases at the corners of his mouth, and his jawline was misshapen, as if he'd recently had teeth removed, and not consensually. What's this regarding? Thompson asked. He fixed her with his cold, unblinking gaze. A crack of thunder rattled the windows. I think it's better for the both of us if I save that information for the special agent in charge. It's late, sir. SAIC Yancey left hours ago. He's probably asleep by now. Then pick up the phone and wake him up. He banged a fist on the front desk to accentuate his point, and only then noticed the security guards. There were four of them. They'd come running when they heard Thompson's distress signal via their walkies. Three fanned out to flank him, guns drawn. One attempted to approach him from behind, his hand resting on his holstered weapon, but froze when the man wheeled on him. Don't move, one of the guards shouted. Hands in the air. The stranger crouched into a forward fighting stance, his eyes darting from one guard to the next. Despite his age and his disheveled appearance, he was corded with lean muscle like a middleweight boxer. The guards tensed, their fingers tightening on their triggers. I'm not playing, asshole. Get on the ground now. Thompson stood and put her hands up, palms out, a calming gesture. Whoa, easy, guys. Everyone just take a breath. I'm sure we can sort this out. In that moment, lightning struck the building. The thunder that accompanied it was immediate, deafening. The lobby plunged into darkness, and the stranger made his move. He lunged at the nearby guard, his left hand extended. A flash of gunfire lit the room, blinding Thompson momentarily, as one of the other guards discharged his weapon. The bullet zipped through the space he'd just vacated and dimpled the far wall. Then the web between the man's thumb and forefinger connected with his quarry's throat. The guard gurgled sickeningly as his airway collapsed. He would have fallen had the man not grabbed his trachea in a pinch grip and yanked, twisting his wrist so that the guard's back wound up pressed against his chest, a gasping, wheezing human shield. The man drew the guard's sidearm and opened fire. Thompson saw the rest unfold in freeze frames, the darkness punctuated by lightning and muzzle flashes. One guard's knee exploded and he went down screaming. Another took rounds to the shoulder, the wrist, the hip. The last guard standing rushed the man and tried to tackle him. The man released his human shield, who slumped, unconscious, to the floor, sidestepped the assault, grabbed his would-be attacker by the hair, and drove his knee into the man's nose. Then he yanked the guard upright, blood spraying in an arc from both nostrils, and tossed him through a glass display case. Less than 30 seconds had elapsed since the storm had knocked out the building's power. Thompson clutched her shiny new sidearm in trembling hands and waited for the lightning to reveal her target. The emergency backup lights kicked in, illuminating the falling guards. Their assailant was nowhere in sight. Thompson, feeling suddenly exposed, took cover in the footwell of the desk. For a long while, nothing happened. The only sounds she heard were the static hiss of the rain against the windows and her own shallow, panicked breathing. Eventually, she mustered up the courage to climb out from beneath the desk and turn around. When she emerged, she felt a gun barrel, still warm from firing, press against the back of her head. "Put your weapon on the ground and get up slow." She did as he instructed, her hands raised, her heartbeat a manic drumroll in her chest. "Listen very carefully," he said. "I don't give a flying what time it is. Get your goddamn boss on the line and tell him that the devil's red right hand would like a word with him."
It's such a cool, explosive opening to the book. I was going to save this question for later, but because that sets the pace for the rest of the novel, I'd actually like to talk about pacing, because pacing in thrillers seems to be something very important, but also tricky to manage, the balancing character development with keeping the action going. What is the secret to doing that?
Well, in my case, I can tell you that the secret is copious editing. This book maybe only went through three drafts or so before we kind of locked it down, but they were three brutal drafts. My agent used to be an executive editor at Doubleday, and he's got a brilliant editorial eye. So he beat up my first draft, and then my editor, Josh Kendall, really beat the hell out of the second draft.
Hmm.
And you know, we just keep iterating and working on pace, on tightening down the scenes that do work, on moving around the scenes that don't, or restructuring them completely. And in the case of this intro, it did play out in flashback later in the book. But the unfortunate aspect of that is it lacks immediacy. As soon as you tell it in flashback, you're already in a past passive voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't have that same punch. Initially, the book opened with what's actually the first chapter, a family trying to take a video of the Golden Gate Bridge and inadvertently capturing images of a terror attack. And I love that chapter. I think it's a really suspenseful chapter because it's so peaceful until all hell breaks loose.
Right.
That when you know you're reading a thriller, you're waiting for that other shoe to drop. But the point that Josh made when he recommended moving this scene up to the front and using it as a prologue was, once you see the violence that this character is capable of, you spend the rest of the book waiting for that violence to recur. And I thought that was a brilliant note. So for me, it never comes out exactly right the first time. It's always a process of iteration, of pruning, and of being open to some big ideas about moving the book around.
So when you say three brutal drafts, are we talking full rewrites of the manuscript, or just really cutting out a lot of unnecessary stuff and moving things around?
Yeah, it's by brutal, I think what I mean is everything is on the table.
Mm-hmm.
when it comes to these drafts. I'm somebody who writes with a lot of drafts just naturally. This book was done on a very tight timeline. Normally, I would do 6 or 7 drafts. Wow. And this book was written in about 6 months, kind of start to finish, until it was pretty much locked. So to do that, I really had to put it in front of people before I was comfortable showing it to others. Normally, it'd go 2 or 3 drafts, just my eyes on it, or maybe my wife's. My wife's a bit of a ringer as a first reader because she reviews for Kirkus and Publishers Weekly and Mystery Scene Magazine. So she's pretty knowledgeable when it comes to.
Oh, that's not fair.
Yeah, right. She's you know, better read than any 10 other crime readers, which is pretty terrific for me. Unfortunately, she's lousy as a yes man. She won't let me get away with anything, so she really beats me up. But it makes the books tighter. So normally, she and I would spitball it for the first few drafts. With Red Right Hand, we didn't have that luxury. So I had to put it in front of people, you know, who have edited the likes of John Grisham and Peter Straub and David Morrell before I even felt like it was good. It felt like a hazing experience, but it ultimately was excellent for the book.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nacht Sound Engineering. Nacht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nacht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nacht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nacht Sound Engineering today at nachtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nacht, more than a stack of tracks. So you've done this several times now. You've got the Collector Trilogy, you've got some short pieces, and you've got these two Michael Hendricks books. Does it still feel weird when you put it in front of an editor? Is it still like, what's going to happen?
You know, I actually really love being edited. I think that's where the book takes shape. I always say it's a lot easier to make a good book out of a book than it is to make a book out of nothing. Mm-hmm. So I actually find the first draft to be the most grueling part of the process. I love collaborating. I love editing. I love spitballing ideas. But yeah, it is. It's always gut-wrenching to put a book in front of somebody for the first time. I feel like every book I write teaches me how to write that book. And I still feel as if I'm starting from scratch every time I write a new book. I will say the entire Collector Trilogy, it sort of blended detective fiction and the fantastic. And as such, it was told in the first person. So for me, writing thrillers felt like a pretty radical departure. First of all, it robs you of that conversational tone of writing in the first person, mm-hmm. Which for me is my natural storytelling voice. But the flip side of that is you're able to generate so much suspense when you can cut to different people in different scenes without having to worry about keeping your main character involved in every scene that's on screen.
Right. Yeah, I'm finding that now because I tend to write in third person and being able to head hop from chapter to chapter allows you to flesh out the book quite a bit and fill in, you know, in my mind, it helps me make the villains more three-dimensional because I can get inside their heads.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely agree. Although one thing that was a big learning curve for me was simply deciding what to cut to
right.
when I cut away. And to that end, very early in the editing of The Killing Kind, my editor Josh had this great point that's really stuck with me. And maybe it's something that people who naturally write in the third person have internalized without realizing it. But for me, it was mind-boggling. He said, try to think of the book as a conversation between your protagonist and your antagonist.
Hmm.
He said, you know, first your protagonist may speak, and then your antagonist speaks, or vice versa. And from then on, it's essentially a conversation or a dialogue between the two. And occasionally other smaller characters might chime in when they have something to say. But primarily, if you think about it as a dialogue between protagonist and antagonist, that really, at least in my case, helps me decide what that appropriate next chapter or next step is. Because I'm not an outliner. I write from the seat of my pants. which means, you know, when I chapter break, I don't necessarily know what's coming next. I have to make it up as I go.
And that's actually why I love the first draft process, because it's all discovery. And I've been outlining more, but I'm the same way. Usually the first couple of books I wrote were all pantsed. And so just that whole act of, you know, figuring out what's going to come next was always more fun to me than sitting down and taking my scissors to the bonsai tree. Because by the time I get through like a second or third draft, it's like, I hate these people. I never want to see them again. I'm putting them in the drawer and we're never talking. So yeah, it's interesting how you really like the editing process, and I'm the exact opposite.
Yeah, I'll tell you though, it's funny. Usually when I turn in a book, I hate it. By the time I'm done with it, I've been through seven drafts or so, and I think it's complete garbage and I never want to think about it again. I was convinced that The Killing Kind was going to end my career by the time we turned it in, because I was like, oh God, it's terrible. I can't stand to look at it. And fortunately, I was wrong about that. What's funny is by the time we got Red Right Hand into shape, I actually kind of liked it. And paradoxically, that made me worry, because I was like, okay, my other books were well received and I couldn't stand the sight of them by the time I turned them in. What's it mean that I liked this book? Is everybody else going to hate it? And thankfully, so far, that hasn't been the case.
That's interesting. That is it that you're getting more eyes on it and they're showing you things you didn't see before? And so sort of through them, you're seeing it with newer eyes? Or do you think it's something else?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was. I think in this case, it was such a freewheeling collaboration, and it was such a grueling process throughout that I was able to see it. Yeah, maybe through their eyes a little bit, or maybe just not as my own work product, but as more of a group effort. Which is funny, because I mean, the writing is still all mine. The decisions are ultimately still all mine. But there was something about that compressed timeline that just felt kind of all hands on deck. And I can see how far the book came in such a short period of time. I think that was really the most gratifying part. And I think also every writer has this sort of platonic ideal in their head of the book that they're trying to write. Yeah. And for whatever reason, this one just came closer to that, to the version of the book that existed in my head before I started writing, than maybe anything else I've written.
That's a rarity, because a lot of people, especially me, I get an idea for a book in my head and what I want it to come out as, and when it finally comes out, it's like a child's finger painting. I'm like, this is not what I had in mind.
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with that. That's definitely how they usually feel.
Yeah. Your collector trilogy, I believe, blends magic and realism. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Red Right Hand and The Killing Kind are strictly realism. They're contemporary thriller fiction. Mm-hmm. And Michael Hendricks exists in a world where ISIS is real, 9/11 happened. How was that, you know, transporting everything from a place where magic exists to what is currently a world where magic has died?
That's a great way to put it. So first of all, the Collector trilogy sort of recasts the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned crime pulp. So you've got, you know, angels driving Crown Vicks and demons running speakeasies, that sort of thing.
Oh, cool.
And it features a guy who is essentially a PI figure, but he actually is condemned to hell, to an eternity of servitude to hell for a deal he made to save his dying wife. And now he collects the souls of the damned, which is, you know, where the Collector series comes from. He's a soul collector. And I always kind of envision that not so much as an intersection between real world detective fiction and fantasy as I did between pulp detective fiction and fantasy. And similarly, I think that although I've jettisoned the magic, Michael Hendricks still exists in a slightly heightened version of our world. It's still a little bit pulpier, a little bit grittier than our world.
Are you sure? Are you sure about that?
You know, I'll tell you what, I've had some crises of confidence with regard to that lately. And I've also, in all seriousness, with regard to the state of modern geopolitics, I've taken a long, hard look at my current work in progress and thought, is this really bizarre enough? I can push this darker and weirder, I think.
And then it's next week.
Yes, exactly. But no, in all seriousness, when it came to the Collector series, everybody wanted to give me credit for the wildly inventive weird stuff. The wildly inventive weird stuff is easy, right? You can do anything you want. What's difficult is writing the stuff that's more grounded in reality.
Right.
For example, I once wrote myself into a corner in the third collector book where I had a character who was stranded in the Carpathian Mountains and needed to get to LA quickly. And so I just invented this crazy tequila-inspired concoction where he chugged this potion, swallowed this worm, and the worm ate him from the inside out and, you know, digested him and spit him out someplace else, which is insane, but it worked. If I want to get Michael Hendricks across the country when the nation's on lockdown, I need to come up with something that makes sense, that, right, that people actually buy, because readers just aren't going to put up with the same sort of tomfoolery that I got away with in my fantasy series. So I find writing the real world much more challenging than writing, you know, imaginative, speculative fiction.
Right. And what's the research for that? You know, because there's also a lot of computer technology that has to be dealt with, like the antenna that he hacks into with, mm-hmm, with the help of his partner, Cameron, and, you know, all the hacking that goes on. So what kind of research went into making sure all of that was realistically sound?
Oh, no, I just made that all up.
Oh, okay. Next question.
Yeah, no, I tend to research as I go because my background is in science. I was a molecular biologist, and I've found that if I try to research something ahead of time, I will fall down a rabbit hole, and I can research for weeks, mm-hmm, without actually getting any writing done. So what I tend to do is research on the fly, which slows down my writing considerably, but it means I only research things that I know need to get on the page, which is helpful, but it also means I tend to write with an incognito window open so that I'm not tempted to check my social media. And I'll be on Google and Google Maps and Wikipedia and various, you know, sources, both academic and mainstream. And because I write on the fly, I don't know where things are going to take me until I get there. In the case of, you mentioned the cow, the cell on wheels antenna that they, mm-hmm, hack into, that was just a happy accident. I was researching our modern surveillance state and stumbled across this I believe it was a Slate piece talking about sort of the weaknesses of our modern cell systems, and I believe it was the same piece that led me to the cell on wheels and also the Stingray device, which is a fascinating device that was developed for the CIA that law enforcement now use, which basically sends out a signal, a pilot signal that mimics that of a cell tower. Yeah, and then any cell phones in the area try to connect to this device, assuming that it's the cell tower. And as soon as they do, their metadata is accessible by the people who are operating the Stingray. Just some fascinating stuff out there.
Yeah, I remember. I think The Verge had a long form piece about it too. They did a whole interview with the guy who was in jail and then ended up putting out, you know, finding out how all of this worked.
Mm-hmm. And I remember what's funny is right before my book came out, Joe Finder, who's got a terrific online presence, was sharing all these cool pieces on Facebook about little bits of tech and tradecraft that were going to be in his upcoming thriller. And he was like, let me tell you about a little device known as the Stingray. And I thought, damn it, Finder's going to do this better than I did. but yeah, you know, I think it's just a matter of, I'm fascinated. I think as most serious, writers are, I'm fascinated by everything. I'm fascinated by how big stuff works, but I'm also fascinated by how little stuff works. You know, the lock on your front door, things like that. And so I always kind of poke around for interesting random facts, and if I stumble across something that I think is interesting or creepy or, you know, potentially terrifying for the government to have their hands on, I sort of file that away to use at a later date. One of the things that didn't make its way into this book that I really wanted to use was I ended up watching a presentation from DEF CON, the Hackers Conference, about elevator hacking. That absolutely scared the shit out of me. Apparently, back before computer hacking was a thing, phone freakers would hack the phone systems in the United States, and elevator hackers would hack the elevators for sport. And what you can do with a modern elevator system is mind-boggling. So hopefully someday I'll get a chance to use that before I die in a horrible elevator accident.
I had just read a thing today, and I believe it was a hoax. It was debunked, but someone had posted that hackers had hacked a hotel and had put ransomware on all of the door locks, and so the hotel wouldn't be able to, people wouldn't be allowed out of their rooms until the hotel paid up, which I think it was completely false, but it was an interesting possibility. Like, could this really happen? Could you actually lock someone in their hotel room until the hotel paid up?
The fact that it seems momentarily plausible. Well, right. I'll give you some examples of things that are capable in elevators. All elevators have an emergency phone line, but on more than one occasion, hackers have actually called into that phone line and opened it so that they can record the conversations that happen on the elevators, which you could imagine if say, you know, the UN were in session, there might be some interesting conversations in elevators in certain buildings. Huh. Every elevator also, as long as it was built, I believe, after 1992, needs to be accessible by a universal fire key. And I hate to say this to your listeners and give anybody ideas, but there are websites on which you could easily purchase a universal fire key, even though it's illegal to do so. And so this presentation that I was watching was a couple of security experts who basically their job is to go and hack people's elevators just to demonstrate what the weaknesses are. And they did it in airports, they did it in hotels, they did it in prisons. And man, it's some genuinely chilling stuff. You realize that the more we surround ourselves with this everyday technology, the more vulnerable we make ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about vulnerability. I don't know if you've ever read Jeff Mayno's book, A Burglar's Guide to the City.
Mm-hmm.
I had interviewed him, I think, last season about the book. And it's all about, because he runs an architecture blog, and this is all about how architecture is exploited by burglars to gain entry where they're not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And there were stories like a guy who was living inside a Toys R Us and robbing the register every night.
Wow.
Yeah, there is some crazy stuff out there. And then, you know, some of the more benign things like people who take classes on lock picking and things like that. But, you know, if you want to get insight into how a burglar thinks and how they never see a front door as a way in, they always find the window or sometimes just burrowing through a wall. They'll always find a different way in than what's intended. It makes you see the buildings and the world around you in a much different light, or the way Los Angeles is laid out in a way for their helicopter surveillance teams to better find people who are on the loose.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell you, my grandfather on my mom's side was a cop. He rose from the beat all the way up to deputy chief of police in Syracuse, New York. And he did that largely on the strength of a couple of major organized crime busts. He never locked his doors.
Hmm.
Here's a guy who had every reason to worry about some repercussions from some of the things he'd done throughout his career. And he never locked his doors because, as he said, if they want to get in, they're going to get in. There's no use breaking our door to do it.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's why a lot of places will leave the register open, even if they move the money somewhere else for the night. They'll leave the register open when they leave to go home because they know the first place they're going to look is the register, and why break the register?
Sure, it saves them money on replacing the register. That's
exactly.
Terrific.
I'd like to talk to you about the Michael Hendricks and the love of the anti-hero and who, the people who come to mind, Dexter Morgan from the Dexter series, Lawrence Blocks Keller, the other hitman with a heart of gold. You know, why do we keep coming back to the anti-hero as the hero?
That's an excellent question, and it's something I've thought about a lot. One of my favorite authors is Donald Westlake, and he wrote probably my favorite anti-hero in history under the name Richard Stark. His Parker books, I think, are one of the finest crime series ever written. And I was recently lucky enough to write a foreword for one of the University of Chicago Press reissues. And so I've been really thinking about what it is that so appeals about anti-heroes. And I think the answer is a fewfold. First off, I think the classic conception of a true hero is something of an outdated character, because it's not truly a fully fledged character. It's more of an archetype.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got somebody who's pure good, they're not that interesting on the page, right? Because you know that they are always going to do what's right.
Right. That's why Batman is a more interesting hero than Superman ever was.
Precisely. If you have somebody who's pure evil, you always know what they're going to do. The mustache twirling villain. Mm-hmm. What I'm really fascinated in is that vast gray area in between. And I think anti-heroes are like a gut check. They allow us to ask, what if? Because in Hendrik's case, I suppose in strictest terms, he is a sociopath, in the sense that he sort of flouts social conventions. He kills people for a living, but he's not psychotic. He has a conscience. He has a moral code. It's just a little bit contrary to what would be considered sort of traditional moral values. Mm-hmm. And I'm always interested in pitting him against people who maybe don't have a code, who don't have that line that they won't cross. And I think, you look at the great anti-heroes throughout history, whether it's Parker, who's a bastard and a criminal, but he himself has a moral code. It largely consists of he won't double cross anybody he's working with, and he'll only kill if he needs to. But he does have a code. Dexter is another great example of a killer with a code. But they're always a slightly darker shadow of ourselves, right? Like, we all are maybe a little less decent than we would like to think we are. And these characters sort of edge right up against the really dark moral questions about what we truly are capable of. And they also, I think, maybe peel back the veneer of civilization that we all sort of like to pretend exists and show mm-hmm. us the rot that lies beneath.
That's a similar philosophy for the Punisher, who is one of my favorite characters in mm-hmm. comic books. But it's like the Joker says in the Killing Joke storyline, where he says you're basically me, except you didn't get that one bad day. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, your parents were killed and you have all this money and everything, but, Batman is still, he didn't get pushed so over the line that he just eschewed all moral and social responsibility. He didn't have mm-hmm. that one bad day that turned him into the Joker.
Well, and I think that's a great example too, because I think a protagonist is only as interesting and only as capable as his antagonists, mm-hmm. and Batman and the Joker are an excellent example.
Right. You have someone constantly pushing him to the limit to test him, is he as moral and upstanding as he claims to be?
Yeah, absolutely. And, what's interesting is going back to Batman for a second, although we'll jump from Alan Moore to Frank Miller. The character of Cameron in Red Right Hand was very much inspired by Kerry Kelly from The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
Because it's a marvelous comic, but it's unrelentingly bleak. Mm-hmm. With the exception of Kerry Kelly.
Right.
She is this bit of naive exuberance that feels almost jarringly out of place in the story, but it provides this beautiful counterpoint to the place that you find Batman in when the story begins, which is a very, very dark place. Similarly, I knew that Hendrix was going to be in a very dark, destructive mode when the book began, and I knew I needed to introduce somebody that would kind of yank him back from that abyss. Because to me, the story of Michael Hendrix is a story of somebody who desperately wants to redeem themselves for past misdeeds, but really hasn't the faintest idea how to do that. Like, it seems to me, if you want to atone for a life of violence, more violence probably isn't the best way to do that.
Right.
But it's really the only tool at his disposal. And so it's kind of fun to watch him bounce off against somebody who still kind of believes in truth, justice in the American way.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool, so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. Yeah, I'd like to dive a little deeper into Hendrix, because unlike some of the heroes we're used to, like the Jason Bournes and the John Wicks and the people who they walk into a situation, they know exactly what they're going to do and they know exactly how to do it. Hendrix has his instincts, but he doesn't know everything. And at one point in the book, he says, you know, I looked at a YouTube video on how to pick locks and, you know, I just decided to do the you'd shake the lock until the pins fall into place. So he's sort of teaching himself things as he goes along. How did that come about to turn him into someone, or to make him someone who didn't know everything off the bat, that he needed help from other people and that he also needed to just sort of teach himself these things?
Well, you know, I think that the answer is a couple of fold. And one is just the MacGyver effect, right? Like, we love to see people sort of improvise on the page or on screen. It's always fun. And this is not in any way to diss Lee Child or Jack Reacher, but Jack Reacher is preternaturally competent. Mm-hmm. And somehow Child manages to make that interesting. I don't think I could make that interesting. I think that if I were to write somebody who always knew what to do, it would feel like I was going through the motions. Now, for whatever reason, Reacher, it's fun to watch him go through those motions and bash heads and you know, and save the day. In Hendrix's case, I think some of it stems from the fact that he's deeply self-destructive. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of wonder if in his heart of hearts he's really seeking atonement, or if he's just, you know,
he's got a death wish almost.
Yeah, or if he's essentially got a death wish. Yes, precisely. And so, yeah, he's winging it because he just has no shits left to give. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about Hendrix as the genesis of the character, you touched on one of the big touchstones, which was Dexter, because I think that Jeff Lindsay came up with a lightning in a bottle concept when he came up with a serial killer who hunts other serial killers. That was right. Genius. And so obviously that was in the back of my mind when I created the character. But the other character that I always think of when I think of Hendrix is Jack Bauer.
Okay.
Bauer is perplexing to me because he's a guy that, first of all, we see him do horrible things to people, torture people, chop heads off, you know, murder sprees. And yet we never doubt that he is on the side of right, which right. I find fascinating. But the other thing about Bauer is he's only ever superficially troubled by the things he does. You know, he never, it really doesn't weigh on his soul in a major way, because he's like Reacher, is a guy who is fundamentally convinced he's right. I feel like Hendrix was supposed to be the flip side of that coin. He's the guy who did the morally questionable things for his country, but they weigh on him. He's got to live with them. Mm-hmm. And so to me, he's a guy who didn't have all the answers when he started. He was an orphan. He enlisted in the military at 18. He found out he had a knack for killing, but maybe not the stomach for it. And so now he's still trying to figure things out. So I think, yeah, he doesn't know everything. And that you know, is both from a practical and from a moral perspective. And I find that personally rewarding to write, because I'm constantly interested in what he's going to do next.
It makes Hendrix more interesting. And it also, even the villains in the book are much more interesting than your average mustache twirling, world ending, you know, tired of the train tracks kind of villains, which I see in a lot of thrillers. A lot of these guys who, they don't care. It's all about power or money or something. But there are times in Red Right Hand where someone on the council gets a phone call and his daughter is in the next room taking a piano lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that these people have lives outside of killing people. So as they get hurt or die throughout the book, you think, well, how is that going to affect his wife, or how is that going to affect his daughter, or anything like that? It adds a complete other dimension to just they're bad guys and they have to be put down.
Thank you very much. So one of the things, because this book deals with a terror attack on U.S. soil, and this isn't too big of a spoiler, but there's a bomb goes off in San Francisco in the opening chapter, I knew that I wanted to give that its due heft, and I wanted to show sort of the fallout on a human level of mm-hmm. something like this. And what was interesting about that decision, because there's a family in the opening chapter that gets followed throughout the course of the book as sort of the everyday people who are affected by this. And then there's a woman who gets introduced later in the book named Lois, who also is sort of a stand-in for the audience to some extent as to, you know, how we respond in the wake of attacks like this. But what I found really interesting thematically is once I started down that path with essentially bystanders or innocents, all of a sudden I started folding in little snippets of family from some of the other characters, including the antagonists. I'm always fascinated by the idea that everybody feels justified in their own actions. Nobody is a villain in their own story. And I think in terms of one of the primary antagonists in this book, Chet Yancey, you might not like the guy, but by the end of the book, you understand the guy. You understand his motivations. I think he's somebody who feels justified doing the terrible thing because he feels like he's serving the greater good. He's also doing things to protect the people he loves.
Right. That's exactly. Every time he does something and I'm like, oh, this guy's such an a-hole, I think, well, his daughter has twins, and if he doesn't do this, then they're going to get hurt.
Yeah. And, you know, I also, one of the things I will say in The Killing Kind, I did have something of a mustache twirling villain. I had a character who was an absolute psycho who took pleasure in killing. And that's why he was a hitman by trade. But one of the reasons why I chose to do that was because there were two antagonists in that book. One of them was actually the FBI agent who was chasing Hendrix. So I had essentially a good guy who's arguably the moral core of the story who was an antagonist, which kind of, for me, was a fun dichotomy. I figured if I had an anti-hero criminal as the central role, I wanted to have one character who was fundamentally decent but an antagonist, and then one character who was just straight up awful and mm-hmm. an antagonist, kind of throw them all at each other and see what happened. So in this book, I ran away from that a little bit. I thought, okay, I made a memorable villain in The Killing Kind. I need to come up with something new. And I didn't realize at the time how prescient it would be, but Chet Yancey is one of those sort of banality of evil bad guys, right? He's a cog in the machine. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who feels like he's just doing his job and just taking orders and, you know, trying to make the world a safer place. I didn't realize when I wrote that how soon we would be facing circumstances like that in the real world. And so it bums me out a little to see that it wasn't entirely fiction.
Yeah. I did want to jump back a little bit because you had mentioned the terrorist attack on San Francisco. And mm-hmm. When we see terrorist attacks in books or movies, a lot of times it's New York or it's some major metropolitan hub like maybe Chicago or London. But San Francisco was kind of an interesting choice. Why San Francisco?
Well, the short answer for that is this book all stemmed from a scene I had running in my head. And it was the scene that turned out to be that first chapter with the family trying to take a video and capturing a viral. Basically, I had this notion that what if a viral video of a terror attack, that iconic image, and you think of, you know, the planes going into the towers, that one image that gets played over and over on the news, what if it captures an image of someone that doesn't want to be found, that had disappeared? And so I had that notion in my head, and I realized, okay, so the video needs to be of something iconic. It needs to be something that's sort of a symbol of positivity. I mean, the idea being you want something beautiful, something serene, something that is just an overwhelmingly pleasant place and image, so that when you wreak that havoc, the audience feels something. And so very early on, I came to this idea of the bridge, just because it's a beautiful, iconic image. And also because, and again, I don't intend to spoil anything in the book, but this happens fairly early on. The bridge does not come down. The bridge is damaged, but it does not come down. And I thought that was a potent image also.
Yeah, but you have also ruined the opening credits to Full House. So just so you know,
Yes, that's true.
You are a monster, sir.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I got a very favorable review from a San Francisco newspaper, and I was incredibly grateful because I just wanted to be like, I'm really sorry I blew up your city. Because one of the things, and this wasn't, it wasn't intended, or at least it wasn't consciously intended, but one of the themes of the book is about tolerance versus intolerance, you know, plurality versus sort of hardline conservatism and violence. Mm-hmm. I don't mean conservatism in the sense of political conservatism. I mean conservatism in the sense of either Islamic extremism or far-right jingoism. And San Francisco is a city that is essentially a beacon of tolerance and progressivism. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really my intent when I first chose that setting for that to be a theme of the book, but it just sort of naturally flowed from the location that I was writing. So it was a nice resonance. I feel like a lot of writers experience that, where they sit down to write something and they're not even sure why they make the decisions they do, but they all kind of click into place in kind of a, frankly, spooky way when all's said and done.
You know, we had talked about politics before, and I know that I know you and I fall on a similar spectrum of the political thing, but you know, how much does politics affect you, and did it affect you at all while you were writing this book?
First and foremost, as a writer, you know, I just want to tell a great story, and I'm not trying to preach at anybody when it comes to writing my books, although I think it's folly to assume that a writer's views aren't going to creep into their novels. Of course they are.
Right.
So definitely my politics inform my writing. But I will say this, one of the most gratifying things that I can say about my books is I recently had a review for, I want to say it was The Killing Kind. So the first book in the Hendrix series, mm-hmm. from a communist publication in the UK. That championed my work. No, excuse me. It was Red Right Hand, because they said it was a leftist screed against privatization and the surveillance state. And then I was interviewed on a fairly right-wing radio program out of Manhattan, who pretty much took it as, you know, this more of a Jack Bauer character about the, you know, the lone good guy with a gun, you know, wading in and fighting the terrorists and stuff. So I always find it gratifying when people from both sides of the aisle can find something to like in my books.
It's interesting how they interpret it, though, that they see two completely different ideologies going on there.
Yeah, they do. And I think, you know, obviously my politics play a role. I will say I attracted a troll on Twitter not that long ago.
I've seen you deal with a couple.
Yeah, who objected to the fact that I had a prominent gay relationship in the book, and that I also glancingly had a trans character. That deeply upset him to the point where he set the book aside and said that he was going to ask for his money back. I haven't followed up with him to see how that went. And what I wanted to tell him was, man, good luck. But you know, if you hated that, you really would have disliked my collector series, which actually prominently featured a trans character who was also black.
Well, there you go. You've crossed the line.
Yeah, and he also, you know, the trans character was a woman who obviously was born male and was in a committed relationship with a man. And yeah, good thing that fella didn't read those books, because he probably wouldn't have liked him very much. But again, I'm not including you know, gay characters or trans characters or shady private military organizations, necessarily because I'm trying to make a political point, but simply because I'm trying to reflect the world that we currently live in.
Right.
You know, and I would also say, you know, as I mentioned before, Charlie Thompson, the FBI agent, who's one of the main characters in my books, is probably the moral center of the story. And she's, you know, about as law and order as you can get, at least when we first meet her in The Killing Kind.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were writing The Killing Kind, did you expect it to turn into a series?
Yes, actually, I did. So when I was writing my collector books, which are now known as the Collector Trilogy, I assumed I would write that character, Sam Thornton, for a very long time. As it turns out, my publisher had other plans. They decided after the third book that they were interested in seeing something else from me, but that they didn't want another of those books just yet. And so I found myself, you know, at one series end, and I thought, man, I want to write somebody who, you know, really catches on, that I really want to explore for a long period of time. And I sat down with the intention to create a character who could last for an open-ended series, and who would maybe attract a readership that would allow me to do that. And, you know, thankfully, so far, it's been working out.
Excellent. Do you think the thriller genre, not only that it leans towards series, but that the editors prefer the series?
That's an interesting question, because I do think, to some extent, people like to read a thriller series. They like to see a thriller series that catches on. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like plenty of people, myself included, have been encouraged to write standalones as well. And I think, honestly, for me, the perfect balance would be to alternate between writing a Hendrix novel and writing a standalone.
Do you always hope to stay within the thriller genre, or do you plan on branching out at all?
Well, that's a funny question, too, because, you know, my short fiction, I've written 20-some short stories, and they've been fantasy, sci-fi, horror, straight-up crime, and everything in between. I've written a fantasy series. I'm writing a thriller series right now. There's not a lot in the genre spectrum that I wouldn't tackle. I would never write a romance novel, and that's not to disrespect people who do. It's because I would be terrible at it.
That's how I feel about my stuff, too. Yeah, I could never write a romance novel. It wouldn't work for me.
And by the way, I respect the hell out of people who do. That's the genre trenches, man. People who excel in romance do so because you know, they've got it dialed, and it's a difficult thing to excel at.
Hey, if you're able to write a happily ever after in these times, by all means, you have my respect.
By all means. And you know, I also think I would be lousy at writing a Western, but anything else, man, I could see writing a horror novel. I could see writing crime. I'm the book I'm working on right now is a standalone. That's a high concept thriller, with sort of a science fictional bent, not like far future sci-fi by any means, but more like, I don't know. I'd like for it to fall on the spectrum somewhere between William Gibson and Michael Crichton. But yeah, you'll never see a literary novel out of me, because I would suck at that also, because I'm too steeped in genre to ever pull off anything pretentious and literary. It would just be terrible. It'd be tough to read. But yeah, I kind of want to play in every sandbox a little bit.
Yeah, I actually, my novels tend to lean more literary, but I had a short story published that was horror, and the novel I'm working on now is more adventure thriller in the vein of like a Da Vinci Code or a National Treasure, and so that's been interesting to work in, because I've never done anything like that before.
That's fantastic, and I'll tell you, I love good literary fiction, although I tend to gravitate toward literary fiction that is a little more on the plot driven side, because you know, obviously, being somebody who's steeped in genre, that's just, you know, where all my buttons and levers are set. But you know, right now I'm digging into Cloud Atlas, which is absolutely gorgeous. You know, Colson Whitehead is another guy who's just brilliant at you know, bringing literary and genre together.
Oh, Underground Railroad was unbelievable.
Oh God, it was devastating. It was just an amazing novel on so many fronts, but it also, as challenging a read and as important a read as it was, it also completely succeeded as a chase novel.
Yeah.
Because I think he, you know, likes and respects genre conventions. And I think anybody who approaches any genre with disdain is going to do a lousy job at it. But anybody who approaches it with respect, whether that's their sandbox or not, you know, has a decent shot of pulling off something extraordinary.
If you want to read a really solid literary Western novella, Robert James Russell's Mizia is excellent. It's a great literary chase.
Excellent, I'll check that out.
I interviewed him for the show too, and that was one I whipped right through, because not just because it was short, but it was just such a thrilling chase with some really beautiful prose.
That's always the challenge. I find I get slower and slower as a reader, the more I come to value good prose and beautiful writing. As a kid, I'm not sure I even really paid attention to sort of the melody of the words. I just gobbled up story. But I think, you know, in the past decade or so, I've come to savor and read things slowly. And it's always funny when you're reading a really propulsive story and you're torn between wanting to savor the melody of the words and wanting to find out what the hell happens next.
That's how I was with your book. I found myself like reading 10 pages in 5 minutes because I was just sort of like, not skimming, but I was reading really quickly because I wanted to see how this action scene ended and to get to the next part of it. It was, when I'm reading quickly like that, I know it's working.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's a high compliment whenever it comes to thrillers. You want to keep people turning pages.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's next? Do you have another Hendrix novel in the works, or are you working on something else?
Yeah. So what I'm working on right now, my agent has essentially forbidden me from saying anything too much about it, but it's an idea I'm pretty excited about. It's something I've been wanting to tackle for a while. My background is in infectious disease research. And so this is a thriller that takes place in the very near future, that folds in some of my background in microbiology, but hopefully, you know, will be recognizably a thriller for people who dig the Hendrix series. And I won't talk too much about the premise, but it definitely, I think, will be reflective of the time we currently live in, where we're looking at, you know, increased government surveillance, closing of borders, a certain measure of fear of people who live outside those borders. Which now I'm making it sound like a zombie novel. It's not a zombie novel, but it's been kind of a thrill for me to get back into a little bit of a speculative vein.
Well, and you said you couldn't write a romance novel. Come on now.
Well, what's funny is I might be the only person who sees it that way, but I actually think that The Killing Kind is in essence a star-crossed romance, because it's about this you know, this tragic figure who is so devastated by the things he's done in war that he feels he's not worthy of, you know, this woman who he left behind, and sort of, you know, his path of redemption to find his way back to her. Although it probably has more like heads exploding and stuff than your average romance.
I think every romance should have more heads exploding.
Well, you know, I'm always reminded of Tess Gerritsen, who, of course, is a terrific thriller writer. But she spent a lot of years in the trenches, you know, writing romance novels. And I don't say in the trenches disparagingly. Like, she was busting her ass getting that done. You know, I think she wrote maybe 10 books. But she, I've seen her speak a few times, and she always jokes about how, you know, when she told her agent she was considering writing a thriller, she was like, yeah, well, you know, a lot of people die in your romance novels, so maybe you should. I guess it was always trying to creep its way out, you know?
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on. This has been great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Where can people find you online?
Well, you can go to chrisholmbooks.com, which has links to me on Twitter and Facebook. If you're looking for me on Twitter, I'm Chris F. Holm. And Facebook, I believe, is also Chris Holm Books.
Excellent. This has been Covered with special guest Chris Holm. Links to Chris's books and all other materials discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can do so at patreon.com/hologramradio. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo, and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Noct Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.
Hello, this is Alex Knight from Hologram Radio, here to tell you about a fun new podcast that we recently launched called Serial Sommelier. Each week, David Kahlo and a guest select a random episode of a much-beloved 1970s and 1980s Saturday morning cartoon series, review the episode, have some laughs, and of course, pair the perfect sugar cereal with it. Subscribe to Serial Sommelier today in iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and of course, wherever you can find your favorite podcasts.